right, so Colin Allen is a provost professor, is a provost professor in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science and the Program of Cognitive Science and the Center for the Integrative Study of Animal Behavior at Indiana University. He has written and edited numerous books on animal cognition and the evolution of mind, including the 1997 Species of Mind with Mark Beckoff. And I think it is no exaggeration to say that he has been instrumental in making the philosophy of animal cognition a proper field of study among his numerous accomplishments. And he also happens to be a world-class mentor. But please don't take my word for it. He also won the Faculty Mentor of the Year Award at Indiana. So please welcome Colin, who will explain why comparative cognition isn't mechanistic enough.
Thanks. So this is actually great, and really appreciate those first two talks and the whole event. I really thought I was going to be a fish out of water in some sense, stuck between all these scientists, but it turns out there's a lot of points of contact from the first two talks to this one, which is really good. And I gave myself a suitably vague title so I could kind of make it up as I went along, but then I gave myself way too specific a subtitle. So, and I realized also some of the things that were said in the last two talks really expressed a kind of humility about the kinds of projects that these scientists have been involved in that I find really valuable and refreshing, and is part of the issues that we're trying to deal with here. So I'm going to get the speculative physiologizing part out of the way right away. And this is a diagram from Conrad Lorenz's Foundations of Ethology, written fairly late in his career after he, with Nico Tinbergen, had won the Nobel Prize. And it's an example of the kind of very sort of impressionistic, for want of a better word, mechanistic models that people were tempted to give, in this case for drives, behavioral drives. Lawrence and Tinbergen actually took this kind of discussion to a physiological meeting in Britain in 1951 and didn't get very far with it among the physiologists. They were not very impressed. It actually, though, relates to a long tradition of making up stories about how things might work. So this is an image that was actually published in a work by Descartes, although he himself did not draw it and may never have seen it, I believe the historians tell us, right? It was sort of a publisher insertion, but showing the pneumatic theory of nervous conduction, where he thought it was all to do with sort of pressures and fluids. But this kind of speculative physiologizing actually really drove an approach to mechanistic biology and physiology more specifically. But even though the details are completely wrong, nevertheless sort of actually inspired a whole bunch of people to go in and look and see what was really happening. All right. So what I'm going to do in the first part is actually do some things that relate to what Laurie was just talking about, and what are we talking about in convergence and cognition. And then I'm going to do what philosophers do, which is get really abstract, but this time about abstraction, so I'm going to be meta-abstractive, right? And then I'm going to come back and try to illustrate the claims I'm going to make with a very specific research program that relates to some of my colleagues' work from Indiana University. So what do we mean by convergence, right? And of course, a lot of what's gone on in this field is finding things such as imitation, tool use, mirror self-recognition, episodic or episodic-like memory, and symbolic communication, and we actually saw some of these pictures in the previous talk, and trying to show that these things are present in some other species, right? So, in fact, this is one of Nikki's photos as well, so we've got good representation in the room. But, of course, this leads to endless sorts of discussions about, well, what do we really mean by imitation, or what do we really mean by tool use, or what do we really mean by episodic memory, right? Is it really the same thing? And I was actually very glad to hear Laurie say, anybody who tells you that they understand what mirror self-recognition means has no clue, right? and I was actually going to illustrate this not by picking on Laurie, but by picking on my friend Onur Günterken, from whose lab the magpie work came, who says, this is my most cited paper. I have no idea what it means, right? Hugely popular, but, you know, no. What does it mean? And the problem is, so a magpie does something interesting in front of a mirror, so what? You can't predict anything else about what magpies will do from this fact, okay? I've taken to calling this kind of research trophy hunting a little bit disparagingly, because it's obviously modeled on trying to show in a point-wise fashion things that we think we can do, and that, you know, anything your species can do, my species can do better, right? Which is problematic, I think, as a research strategy, although it's informative, it's got to inform our research as well, so I'm not completely down on it, right? And part of the problem, too, it comes back to this question of what is convergence, and is this really the same thing? We're relying on some loose notions of similarity here, and the problem is that similarity is in the eye of the beholder, right? And of course, everybody sort of has this trope that you know, people come to look like their pets. I think there's a fair amount of sort of non-uniform causation, let's say, in the way this is set up, right? It's being deliberately exaggerated. But it raises the point here. You can, of course, pick some feature and squint hard enough and it will look similar enough. What do you say about that, right? Why is that interesting? So this is where I go meta-abstraction, right? So what are we doing when we're trying to get to these kinds of claims about convergence, similarity across species? And I tend to be a bit of a geometric thinker, so I like to think about the shape of cognition and thinking about organisms having different shaped cognitions. But nevertheless, if you slice them in particular ways or project them in particular ways, or measure them in particular ways, you might end up with something that you could quantifiably say is similar. And I agree we have to get away from simple linear scales like EQ, right? But I do think, and this is part of my argument, we need to think in terms of how to model this in a quantitative way and tie it to mechanisms. So more specifically, how does this process go? Well, I think the most common one, and the one that I've already suggested is at work in a lot of what I just called trophy hunting, is what I'll call, for want of a better label, monospecific. So we start with some species that we're interested in for whatever reason, and we'll find some dimension of it that we think is interesting, and we'll abstract that dimension, right? And then we'll go, okay, let's look for that in some other species. Can we match it over there? Slightly different shape cognition, all right? And of course, when that starts with humans, what happens is we start with by setting a hurdle and trying to make all of our animals jump over it. Okay, so I might also call this primospecific, or yeah, and you can take that as ambiguously as you like, because it's primates or it's like we're first kind of thing, right? Or homospecific, because we're trying to make everything out to be more or less the same, right? Or human, right? So I was playing with all these labels, I couldn't decide which one I liked the most, so I just thought, throw them all in there, right? And in contrast, and much more rarely, although not completely absent, even represented by some of the work I've already hinted at, there's a more heterospecific approach, where we start with some organisms that are obviously different in their behavior and their capacities, and then we take from each of those some abstraction, which we then can describe as much the same. And I think that I think one example of this is actually all of the good work that's gone on in caching behavior across all the range of seed caching birds, right? So that's not necessarily starting with humans, aren't even in that picture necessarily immediately. You've got a whole bunch of actually quite closely related species mostly doing similar things, caching different foods in different cases, but then you can think of them all as having some common capacities that are driven by a common ecology, all right? But with obvious differences too. So this is the similarities and differences thing going on. But even there, we typically want more. we want to turn that into what I'll call an M-mediated abstraction. So M is here, again, deliberately ambiguous between model and mechanism. But I'm going to start with model. So if you can extract some model or mechanism, right, maybe you can understand these similarities and differences as different parameters on that mechanism. So ideally, then, you can look at, go back at the species that you started with and understand how one of them has a little bit more of one parameter or a different mixture of parameters explaining this variation. Okay? And I think that's a kind of gold standard for model-mediated investigation. And it's a standard that comparative cognition generally rarely meets. Right? We don't have much of a clue, even, what the capacities are that we ought to be trying to parameterize in this way. Although I'm going to try and illustrate this, as I said, concretely with a specific example in a moment. And maybe if that's the gold standard, the platinum standard might be what I'll call... Let me just say one more thing about this. Is if you've got a model with parameters, you can then take it and apply it to other species, right? Different mixtures. So it becomes a predictive model. If you've got some reason for thinking that this is a common model across a range of different organisms and different species, you can figure out how to fit that model to those different species. Okay? So the platinum standard is what I'm going to call MM-mediated, so model and mechanism-mediated. So it's basically the same idea, except we have something more specific to say about why the parameters that we have in our more mathematical model are, in fact, picking up on something that's going on in the mechanism. And of course, what we've seen so far this morning are a couple of mentions of brain size and sociality. But of course, you know, brain size is not a mechanism. It's another trait, right? There was a little bit better than that because there were differential expansion in different parts of the brain. So again, still not a mechanism, still a trait, right? And what I'm going to try and illustrate is how we can take that even sort of deeper into the mechanism in a way. And the work that I'm going to talk about here actually originates with Thomas Hills, who has gone from a PhD at UT Austin in biology to a postdoc at Indiana University, which is where I met him, in cognitive science, to a position in the psychology department at Basel, and now faculty at University of Warwick. So he's a world wanderer, I guess. And he has this really interesting paper, now almost 10 years old, in cognitive science on animal foraging and the evolution of goal-directed cognition. So one problem that all organisms that move face is where to get the next meal. Right? And so this is frequently understood in terms of a mixture of exploration and exploitation. Because if your food in the environment is patchily distributed, right, you've got to decide whether to stick around and exploit the area that you're currently in, or move away and try to find some other patch that you could then exploit. So this balance between exploration and exploitation turns out to be enormously fundamental to all sorts of organisms. Turns out, I found out recently, there are even little fossil tracks of worms doing something like this exploit-explore stuff going on. Okay? And it turns out that there's some optimal theorizing about this that I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but you can write equations that will describe how you would optimize the exploitation of these patchy resources in the environment. And when you look at how organisms actually behave in these kinds of environments, this is actually just a simulation, but it's a very typical sort of pattern. What you find is animals, when they're in explore mode, make relatively infrequent and very relatively low angle turns. So they're not turning very frequently. When they do turn, they're only turning by a small amount. So they're kind of wandering like this. But when they're in exploit mode, they're making frequent high angle turns, right? So they're doing this and sort of covering the space that way. Actually, these fossil worms are really fascinating because it looks like it's an even more primitive form where they actually just made sure they didn't recross their own tracks when they're exploit mode. So they're doing this kind of S thing, but then they'll go off somewhere else and do that S thing again. So that's external cognition, right? They're using the road tracks as a guide to not go back over the same local thing. So this pattern's extremely common in a huge range of current organisms, going from nematode worms to large animals on the savanna. Let me just give you a little example here. So if you look at this, anybody spot the upside down triangle? Raise your hand when you see the upside down triangle. Wait till about 2/3 of you have got it. All right, so it's there, okay, bottom right corner. All right, where is it? So those of you who are, so it's actually up here, right? But how many of you found yourself looking over here first, right? So you'd already learned from here, even though that pattern of hearts is different, you'd already learned from over here that, you know, the resource you wanted was there. We ourselves are driven, right, to search in the same general area before we go searching elsewhere. Okay. So this is an example from that particular paper. All right, so Thomas in his PhD work had worked on dopaminergic and glutamergic regulatory systems of this kind of behavior. All right, so it turns out that dopamine and glutamate are antagonists. It turns out that you have very similar neural structures in both mammals and nematode worms. These different neurotransmitters are affecting the behavior of the system in different ways. And Thomas got a whole story to tell here. I'm not going to give you the whole story, but basically, if you're on the dopamine end of things, which is a common reward signal, you're going to spend a lot of time in one place. And he actually has a whole story here about certain kinds of pathologies as well, where you're just producing too much dopamine, you're going to have more perseverative type disorders. Okay, and if you're got too much glutamate antagonizing the dopamine, or too little dopamine, there's two ways that could happen, right? Then you're going to be more on the ADHD kind of side of things, right? You're going to have attention deficit. You're not going to spend long enough. And it turns out that this mechanism, though, is what regulates. So if I go back to here, this is a cell in the locomotory control circuit of the nematode worm. So these two neurotransmitters are directly regulating how that worm is moving. Okay, so when it's in exploit mode, dopamine's doing its job, and when it's in explore mode, glutamate is antagonizing the dopamine, right? And it is then going to wander off. All right. Interestingly, on top of this, there's a meta-regulatory system, which actually, in some organisms, allows them to adjust on the fly the balance between these two, so that based on what you've been experiencing, you will either do more exploitation or less exploitation, more exploration, based on your recent experience, right? And just to fill in the story a little bit, Thomas thinks that there's a there are disorders of that meta-regulatory system as well, but that's not part of my story today. Right? So if we come back to one of the concepts that came up earlier when Kay was telling us about the puzzle boxes, right? What's patience, right? And Thomas's question, how does this work differently for zoo animals versus animals in the wild? Well, they have learned different things about how quickly they get rewarded for persisting with certain kinds of activities, right? So we can take this nebulous concept like patience and perhaps tie it to specific regulatory mechanisms in the behavior of the organism. And I think the really fascinating step of this is a sequence of papers that Thomas did with a couple of my colleagues who are still at IU. Actually, there's three different colleagues here, Peter Todd, Rob Goldstone, and Mike Jones, applying these ideas to actual memory tasks and other cognitive decision tasks. So search and internal and external spaces, I'll say a little bit more about that one. Optimal foraging in semantic memory. So we all have this metaphor searching our memory. It turns out it may not be a metaphor. It turns out the same regulatory processes are going on for how long you will rack your brain to come up with something that you think is there. All right? And they've even extended this to a story about the central executive process controlling all sorts of planning behavior. So here's the example from this paper. So what they did was they put human subjects now into one of two conditions, where they were moving a cursor around on a screen that's essentially blank, but every time they move the cursor over a nugget, right, it pops up and they get their score goes up, right? And they're either in a situation where those nuggets are clumps or where they're sort of relatively diffuse, and you see people engaging in this kind of cursor behavior in this instance and this kind of cursor behavior in this instance. So people very quickly learn to adjust their behavior to the invisible rewards, right, that come up. And then they took these same people who have been primed in this spatial foraging task and gave them the following task. Here's a list of words. Memorize that list of words. Now, here's a bag of letters, a rack of letters. Think of a Scrabble rack. How many of the words you just saw can you make from these letters? And you can ask for another rack of letters anytime you want. And it turns out that, and that's what these graphs are showing, and I won't go through it in all detail, but the people who are in the clumpy distribution previously stick much longer with a rack of letters, right, than the people who are in the diffuse set, right? So a real effect of a spatial foraging task on a memory task, right? So we begin to see how in fact, these cognitive systems are built out of basic mechanisms that have been there for way more than 95 million years, right? We're going back hundreds of millions of years here, right, to make this connection. So I think I'm about out of time. I've got one more slide. Yeah, this is perfect, yeah, right? Yeah. So I swear I had this slide. I showed it to Thomas. He's my witness. As soon as you said that, like, here's my last slide. The answer is yes and yes, right? That is, what we have is built out of extremely old mechanisms that we have as a result of common descent. But of course, that's gone through all sorts of different pathways and routes to get to where the different species are today. So your dolphin has the same basic regulatory mechanism as we do at this level, but what that dolphin is regulating its behavior over is going to be really different from what a human is regulating its behavior over, or a parrot. But nevertheless, you're going to be able to see ways in which, for perhaps food types, so Jeff Stevens has this interesting paper on patience, where sap-feeding monkeys are much more patient than insect-feeding monkeys, right? They will spend a lot longer at a food site because of the rate at which their food flows, right? So you can see how specific ecological factors could drive differentiation within the same general regulatory framework, right? Similarities and differences all with one framework. And so maybe this also hints at a question, an answer to the question that Russell kicked us all off with, which is, you know, if it were to happen again, would it all happen the same? And I think the answer there is probably yes and no, right? That is, any organism that has to move around in the world and find stuff needs something to regulate that, right? Would it be dopamine and glutamate? Who knows, right? But you've got to have some sort of antagonistic system which will regulate whether you're going to explore or exploit. That's just fundamental, right? That's a very high-level abstraction. We see it everywhere. Once you've got that mechanism, man, you can use it in all sorts of interesting ways, right? Whatever that mechanism is. So with that, the plea is, okay, let's really take up the challenge that I think Laurie was presenting us with, which is, go into this in the level of detail at the level of mechanism and modeling that will help us really figure out what are the interesting commonalities between these organisms. So, thanks very much.